her and kept her and her kids in the basement for 24 years? I do, because I spent many nights reading every horrible specific fact about it and talking about it to everyone who would listen, until one day Seth Meyers gently reminded me that I worked at Saturday Night Live and it was a comedy show and maybe I was bumming everybody out. At the end of the year, the update team surprised me with a framed copy of an Entertainment Weekly cover Seth and I had posed for. They had replaced Seth's face with Joseph Frizzle's. I'm smiling and pulling at his tie. This is what it's like to work in comedy, hilarious and horrifying. Speaking of horrifying, I still troll the internet for terrible stories. I see an awful headline and try not to click it. I often can't believe how hard it is not to read. For a while, I was obsessed with a cable show called I Survived. I was never very interested in the people who were attacked by mountain lions while hiking or the dummies who crashed their single-engine airplanes. Those stories seemed like foolish, risk-taking scenarios I could successfully avoid by never going outside. No, I would watch the horrible pieces on women who had been assaulted and left for dead, first-person accounts of people being attacked by strangers or stabbed by boyfriends. This is the ultimate narcissistic white girl game. I would picture how I would handle the attack differently, or the same. Inevitably, I'd think about my own death, which, next to staring at your face in a magnifying mirror, is probably the worst thing you can do for yourself. The ambulance-chasing aspect combined with the Monday morning quarterbacking of it all is the luxury afforded to those of us left untouched by trauma. Sometimes, I would use these tragedy porn shows to unlock deep feelings, or cut through the numbness. I would read terrible stories to punish myself for my lucky life. Some real deep Irish Catholic shit. Either way, it was all gross and all bad for my health. I remember being depressed after my second boy, Abel, was born. I couldn't lose weight and I couldn't stop working. One evening, Will tried to gently point out that drinking a bottle of wine by myself while I watched Oprah on DVR probably wasn't the best way to feel better. And I remember arguing with him that these shows didn't make me feel sad. They were real. They were emotional. They were what I needed to feel better. Then Oprah's show came on and she announced the topic was African baby rape. I was forced to admit perhaps it was time for a break. Let's not end on African baby rape, or start with it, for that matter. Let's end by pointing out all the positive ways you can scare yourself and feel alive. You can tell someone you love them first. You can try to speak only the truth for a whole week. You can jump out of an airplane or spend Christmas Day all by your lonesome. You can help people who need help and fight real bad guys. You can dance fast or take an improv class or do one of those Iron Man things. Adventure and danger can be good for your heart and soul. Violence and desperation are brutal things to search out. Why search out the horror? It's around us in real ways every day. I'm talking to you, the people who made that movie, The Human Centipede. No more Human Centipede movies, please. No more movies about people's mouths being sewn onto people's butts. The whole idea of making and watching a movie like that makes me want to take a 10-year nap. Having said all this, I would like to pitch some taglines for the inevitable next Human Centipede movie. It all makes sense in the end. From your mouth to God's butt. Run, don't walk, to this movie. Unless you are a human centipede, in that case, crawl. Human centipede? No thank you, please. Reasons we cry on an airplane. Number one, we are a little drunk. Number two, we are a little scared. Number three, we feel lonely, which is different than being alone. Number four, we are missing someone or have just left someone. Number five, we're headed towards our family and can't stand our cousins. Number six, we feel like time is suspended and therefore we can feel real emotion without consequence. Number seven, we look out the windows and see the sky and are reminded of how amazing it is to get into a giant steel bird and not have to die on the trail like our forefathers. Number eight, we've just watched a movie, any movie. Recent movies I've cried to include 21 Jump Street, That's My Boy, The Taking of Pelham 123, and Jackass 2. Number 9, the pressure. Number 10, the pressure. Different. Let me ask everyone in the booth here a question. How am I doing so far, guys?
You're doing great.
You're doing great, sweetheart.
I, for one, am enjoying myself.
Thank you.
You're doing great.
Humping Justin Timberlake. I was hired on Saturday Night Live in August 2001. We were supposed to have our first read-through on 9/11. I turned 30 years old 5 days later. My first year was a total blur that consisted of my trying not to get fired and trying not to die. It was a tough time to join the show. It felt like America might not ever smile, never mind laugh, again. I hoped that the entire idea of comedy would not be canceled, just as I was starting this dream job. I like to refer to the transition period of any new job as finding out where the bathrooms are. Not only did I have to find the bathrooms, but I had to attempt to do comedy in a city that was battered and still on fire, while avoiding being killed by the anthrax that had been sent to the floors below us. Talk about jitters. Wonderful things happened my first year on SNL. Will and I decided to get married. I met Meredith Walker, who would become one of my best friends and help shepherd smart girls at the party into the world with me. She was tall and from Texas and had already met Sting and Tupac. I got to see Tina Fey and Rachel Dratch every day. I met Seth Meyers in Mike Shoemaker's office, and something clicked inside of me like a broken locket completed. I got to work with Will Ferrell. It's tough for me to find a single story that will really explain to you what SNL felt like or what it meant to me, so I'm not going to try. I told you, writing is hard. In lieu of that story, I present to you my bite-sized SNL memories mixed in with some benign gossip about past hosts. Enjoy! My first show was September 29th, 2001. I walked in the background during a Wake Up Wakefield sketch, but according to my parents, you couldn't see me. Paul Simon sang The Boxer, and Lorne Michaels solemnly asked Mayor Giuliani, "Can we be funny?" The mayor paused and answered, "Why start now?" Lorne wrote that joke. We all drank hard with exhausted firefighters at the after party, their uniforms still covered with dust. The first time I appeared on air was the last sketch of the night a week later. I wrote it and played a porn star on a date with Sean William Scott. Seconds before we went live, Lorne asked me if I wanted white or red wine in the prop wine glasses. I still don't know if he was genuinely asking or doing some kind of Jedi mind trick to help me be less nervous. In that same episode, Will Ferrell played an overzealous office worker who displays his patriotism by wearing an American flag Speedo. I watched him spread his legs and realized that America could and would laugh again. A few shows later, Will and I wrote a sketch where we played two background actors, and I realized I wasn't going to be fired. Will Ferrell is one of the most naturally talented people I've ever met. He was our benevolent captain and will always be a hero in my eyes because, number one, he used his talent to heal me and the country in ways he will never know, and two, he is a straight-up king. Later in my first season, they pulled host Britney Spears out of a cold open because she didn't have time to change. I did her part with 5 minutes prep. It was a skiing scene, and I may have worn her clothes. I also think I said live from New York for the first time. For some reason, I feel like Dan Aykroyd was also in it. I'm not sure. I could fact check this, but I'm too lazy. Britney Spears also signed a poster for me that hung in my office. I don't know where that poster is now. Molly Shannon, Kristen Wiig, and I all had that office at some point in our SNL careers. Each one of us carved her name in the desk. One night, Chris Parnell hid under that desk for an hour while I was writing. He kept gently hitting my drawer so it would spring open. I couldn't figure out what was going on, and so I looked below to investigate, and he was curled up in a ball, and I screamed my head off. There was a lot of pranking. Horatio Sanz used to call me and pretend he was a weird gentleman named Gomez Vasquez Gomez. Writer Andrew Steele used to leave us notes from a pervert named Thurman, letting us know he was a big fan of butts and boobs. Will Forte would call writer Emily Spivey and me and ask us to work on a sketch, and then we would come in to find him and his writer office mates Leo Allen and Eric Sloven completely naked at their desks. We were never fed and were left to our own devices when it came to meals. Interns would go on McDonald's runs and buy a shitload of horrible candy. A lot of time was spent ordering food and waiting for it to be delivered. The traffic around 30 Rock often meant that we were constantly starving and complaining. One time, Sloven was bitching about how his food was taking forever, and once it arrived, Forte grabbed it and threw it out the window. I cried a lot in Mike Shoemaker's office. Once, a few years after 9/11, I did a 9/11-based joke on Weekend Update during rehearsal. It didn't go well, and I came off stage and cried to producer Mike Shoemaker about how bad I was at telling jokes and how I wanted to quit. I also cried a lot in Maya Rudolph's office and in Emily Spivey's office, and in elevators. Some of the crying was from exhaustion or stress, and some of it was just the bitter burn of rejection. A teeny tiny cleaning lady named Rosa had worked at SNL for over 30 years. She barely spoke English, and we all loved her. Maya and I were both crying about something, and Rosa came in to empty the wastebasket. She put her hand on Maya's shoulder and in a thick Spanish accent said, "No, don't cry, sexy." Tina wrote a sketch where Chris Kattan and I played a white trash couple. It was very physical, and I blacked out during a show when I was flipped over upside down into a dumpster. I woke up to Kattan standing over me and yelling. John Goodman was the host that week and is probably still my favorite because he was nice to me when no one knew my name. Once, after a long after party, I was outside smoking with Weekend Update writer and future Parks and Recreation creator Mike Schur. Seth Meyers was also there, as well as many other men whose opinion I cared about. Host Ashton Kutcher walked out of the party and headed to his limousine. He casually said goodbye to me, and I loudly and sincerely shouted like a crazy fan, "Love you, Ashton! You're the best!" It was very uncool. It was much too loud. When he hosted, Sir Ian McKellen greeted us every day by booming out in his perfect voice, "Good morning, actors!" Colin Farrell was super hungover and super nice. Hugh Jackman was incredibly kind and sent everyone a case of Foster's beer. Jessica Simpson was the prettiest host I had ever seen without makeup. Bernie Mac was the sweetest and kindest. Matthew McConaughey wore a sarong in Lauren's office. I danced at a club with Christina Aguilera, and Antonio Banderas smelled the best of any host. I made a drink for James Gandolfini to settle his nerves before an update piece he was doing. Once I asked Paul Giamatti during the show if he was having fun, and he smiled and said, "This is a fucking nightmare." When Ashley Simpson's song screwed up, Dratch, Maya, and I were dressed in Halloween costumes for Parnell's Merv the Perv sketch. We screamed and ran into Tom Broker's wardrobe department and hid under a table. Maya was dressed as a pregnant woman in a cat suit. I was Uma Thurman from Kill Bill. Dratch was Raggedy Ann. I remember us huddling together, buzzing about the excitement of that weird live moment, and then someone saying, "At least 60 Minutes is here." For those who don't remember, 60 Minutes was doing a profile on Lauren and happened to be there. Jackpot, Leslie Stahl. One time, Maya, Queen Latifah, and I were in a sketch where we had to sing a few songs as backup singers. 5 seconds before we went live, our stage manager, Jenna, told us there was a problem with the track and we had to sing without music. We looked at each other wide-eyed and excited. When that sketch was over, Latifah said, "That was crazy!" And we high-fived. I sat in on Prince's soundcheck. He was the musical guest, and Steve Martin was the host. He walked over to me after he was done. My musician friend and lifelong Prince fan, Amy Miles, burst into tears, and I turned to Prince and awkwardly asked him, "How was your summer?" I'm such a fucking loser. When U2 performed, Bono came over to hug me. My whole body blushed, and I almost died from excitement and fear. Years later, I paid him back by making out with him during a bit at the Golden Globes, thus completing a circle and allowing myself to effectively time travel. Speaking of time travel, I did a sketch with Jon Bon Jovi where I was a 14-year-old version of myself and he stepped out of a poster. The set was designed like my actual bedroom as a child, and Spivey and I had a long discussion about what brand of hairspray should be on the dresser. I think White Rain won. Jon Bon Jovi went into his own archives and got out the actual outfit he had worn 20 years before during the Slippery When Wet tour. It still fit. Jon Bon keeps it tight. I wrote that scene and most of my favorite scenes with Emily Spivey. Spivey is an insanely talented writer and actor from the Groundlings via North Carolina. She has a sharp tongue and a gifted sense of character, and we would huddle together on Tuesday writing nights and try to do a jam out, which basically meant write something fast and fun. Out of that came Caitlin, the hyperactive girl with a heart of gold. Caitlin had boundless optimism, and she was a tribute to all latchkey kids who had to amuse themselves. It was also an homage to a Gilda Radner sketch called The Judy Miller Show. Spivey and I would spend hours talking about the genius of Gilda, or Jan Hooks, or Phil Hartman. We were also obsessed with the song I'm No Angel by Greg Allman for some reason, and we spent our whole tenure at SNL trying to get that song into a sketch. It ended up being the soundtrack to a scene where the super pregnant me hits on Josh Brolin in a honky-tonk bar. Spivey was also pregnant at the time. It might have been the only time two pregnant women wrote a scene about a pregnant woman on SNL. Spivey and I wrote a sketch based on a real moment we had with the handsome and talented Justin Timberlake. He was hosting and came into the office one writing night. We both got very flummoxed, and it caused us to write a scene where I was attempting to give him notes backstage during a show. I was dressed as a leprechaun with a giant orange wig. I ended up getting tongue-tied and eventually just started humping on him. Justin had a lovely southern woman who was his ex-teacher and handler at the time, and she did not think it was a good idea for him to be shirtless during this sketch. I point to these boundaries as one reason why Justin has kept his shit together. I once wrote a sketch where Steve Martin and I were two drunk people applying for a bank loan. It didn't make air, but he still asks me about it sometimes, which is better. You could spend the whole night working on a sketch and arrive the next morning to see that it was not in the read-through packet. Spivey and I wrote a sketch once about two dumb girls in a car shouting out the window to an 18-wheeler semi. The girls kept telling the driver to honk it! Honk it! Come on, honk it! Shoemaker called us the next morning to tell us the sketch wasn't going to be read because there was no way to get a semi into Studio 8H. But I'm sure he pulled it because he was just trying to save us from embarrassment. Read-through days were always exhausting and fun. I sat next to Seth and scribbled notes. Fred Armisen would write end-of-the-year diatribes where he pretended to be angry at everyone. They worked because we all loved Fred, and we knew he loved us. One day before a Wednesday read-through, Rachel Dratch threw her back out and had to lie on the floor. Host Johnny Knoxville offered to help and pulled 10 loose pills out of his pocket before realizing none of them were painkillers. A hot NBC doctor came upstairs, and all the single guys started hitting on her. Rachel did the entire first half of the read-through from the floor. We had a sexual harassment meeting once, and I spent the whole time sitting next to Will Forte drawing penises. At the end of the meeting, I was asked to hand in the sign-in sheet, and I gave the guy the penis paper by accident. Tracy Morgan used to tell us, "Don't peek at dress! Don't let the pages jinx your shit!" Paula Pell was usually the funniest person in the room, or Fred Armisen, unless Baldwin was there. Debbie Downer was one of the few sketches where I broke, and I remember watching Horatio Sanz laugh so hard that tears squirted out of his eyes. I still believe that sketch may be a cure for low-level depression if watched regularly. Jim Downey ignored the fact that I never did a good impression of Hillary Clinton and used to sit with me between dress and air going over his notes for the scenes he had written. It took me a while to find a real take on her. We used to use videotapes to help with impressions. And I would take my tapes into Daryl Hammond's room, where he would give me tips on how to sound like Hillary. I gave her a crazy laugh, which she didn't have in real life. And as the election year progressed, I loved getting to play her as this highly focused and slightly angry woman who was tired of being the smartest person in the room. I secretly hoped she watched some of my sketches and could live vicariously through the things I got to say. The memories I have with Seth could fill a whole book. When I left SNL, I gave Seth a badge of courage, like Dorothy gives to the Cowardly Lion. The props department helped me make it. He kept it in his pocket during update until he didn't need it anymore. Now it sits in a box on his desk at late night. When Tina left, I gave her dog tags that read, "Pleasant Tomorrow." Recently, she gave them back to me while I was going through a tough time. I like to think we will give them back and forth to each other whenever needed. Bronx Beat was a sketch that was a dream to write and perform. Maya and Spivey and I would just improvise for hours in their office. We named those characters after Jody Mancuso and Betty Rogers in the SNL hair department. Jody had that accent and that attitude. And Maya and I would just sit on set a few minutes before our scene went on the air and just talk to each other in character. I spent many nights in Spivey's office, smoking out the window and staring at the Empire State Building. I spent many nights in Tina's office watching her write and pretending to help her. I spent many nights in Seth's office watching him write and adjusting his temperature and lighting. I watched the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree lighting from Lauren's office, and all I remember thinking is, "Oh, I'm so tired." Most of the bigger moments in my career happened in that office. Steve Higgins brought me in there to tell me I was hired. Lauren called me in there to tell me I was doing update. He told me that once I said my name, everything would change. He was right. Lauren once told me that he was never nervous when I was out there. He never scared me, and he often made me laugh. He handed me a rope, and it was up to me whether I would climb it or use it to hang myself. He gave kind advice and expected the best from me. He loves his kids, and he paid for me to fix my teeth. One Saturday morning, I bit into a bagel, and the veneer Lauren had bought me popped off my front tooth. I had an emergency appointment at the dentist and spend an entire weekend update living a real-life stress dream that my tooth was going to fall out. Lauren is my friend, and I love him, and I will always be grateful for the huge opportunities he gave me and continues to give me. And I hope one of his assistants will play this for him, because otherwise I'm sure he'll never hear it. Every single time I heard Don Pardo announce my name, I would bow my head in gratitude. Don kept his voiceover booth warm and stocked with goodies. He told me he used to drive to 30 Rock in the 1950s and park right out front. He would record for NBC and then use the $2 he had brought with him to buy a sandwich and a cup of coffee. He was one of the many nonagenarians who still worked on the show. Another was lighting designer Phil Himes. One time, Keenan Thompson was testing with me as a possible weekend update replacement for Tina. Phil took a look at Keenan sitting next to me and said, "Keenan, I hope you don't get this, because there's no way I can like the two of you next to each other." Once, Dratch and I played Michael Jackson and Elizabeth Taylor, respectively, in a sketch where we sat in a tree 20 feet in the air. I looked out over Studio 8H and for the millionth time laughed at my crazy life. Tina and I used to look at each other before update and also laugh at our crazy lives. We would whisper, "We fooled them." Sometimes I would pat her knee. One time I ran into Mick Jagger, Tom Petty, and Eric Idle in the hallway, and I was legitimately mad that they were in my way. But the gratitude never left me. Comedy had not died. Someone was still letting me do it.
Nobody looks stupid when they're having fun.
Every mother needs a wife. I've always had a job, so when I had my two children, I didn't assume I would stop working. I slowed down, which I was happy to do. I was grateful that I could. Most can't. However, I had no plans of being a full-time stay-at-home mother. This is not to say that I think being a stay-at-home mother is not a job. It certainly is. It's just not for me. Remember my motto: good for you, not for me. The whole business of working mothers and stay-at-home mothers is so touchy. Well, tetchy, if you're a Brit. The subject inherently sucks. Not a week goes by without annoying and bullshit articles claiming breast milk makes kids better liars, or you should only have one child unless you live in a farm. We torture ourselves and we torture each other, and all of it leads to a lot of women-on-women crime. Here are some examples. A stay-at-home mother is introduced to someone as Aiden's mom, rather than her own name, which apparently doesn't matter. A working mother is out at a function and people say, "What are you doing? Don't you have little kids? Who's watching them?" A new mother talks about how she's breastfeeding her baby because she just wants her baby to be healthy. A working mother sees a woman breastfeeding and asks her, "Are you still doing that?" A working mother acts like she's too busy to answer emails. A stay-at-home mother acts like she's too busy to answer emails. A stay-at-home mother talks about how she doesn't work because they're only young once and she doesn't want to miss a thing. A working mother talks about how it's not quantity, it's quality. A stay-at-home mother needs a nanny, can afford one, and refuses to hire one, and in doing so denies her kids another caring and nurturing adult and denies herself some much-needed personal time and self-care. A working mother relies too heavily on her nannies and feels defensive about it, so she overcompensates by talking nonstop about some weird music class she took her kid to once. A stay-at-home mother approaches a working mother and grills her about how many hours she works. She gets really interested in what time the working mother leaves in the morning and comes home at night. Then she comments, "I honestly don't know how you do it." I've gotten that last one a lot. The "I don't know how you do it" statement used to get my blood boiling. When I heard those words, I didn't hear, "I don't know how you do it." I just heard, "I don't know how you could do it." And I would be feeling so overworked and guilty and overwhelmed, and suddenly I would be struck over the head by what felt like someone else's bullshit. It was an emotional drive-by, a random act of women-on-women violence. In my fantasy, I would answer, "What do you mean, how do I do it? You really want to know the ins and outs of my nanny schedule? Do you want to know how I balance childcare with my husband and the different ways I manipulate and negotiate work to help me put my kids first when needed? Sometimes I would fantasize about answering the question, how do you do it? With quick one-word answers. Ambivalence. Drugs. Robots. Of course, the ultimate comeback would be, well, obviously you don't know how I do it because you don't do it. You couldn't. What do you do again? See what I did there? Crime. There's an unspoken pact that women are supposed to follow. I'm supposed to act like I constantly feel guilty about being away from my kids. I don't. I love my job. And mothers who stay at home are supposed to pretend they're bored and wish they were doing more corporate things. They don't. They love their job. If we all stick to the plan, there will be less blood in the streets. But let me try to answer the question for real. Do you want to know how I do it? I can do it because I have a wife. Every mother needs a wife. My wife's name is Dawa Choden. Sometimes it's Mercy Caballero. It used to be Jackie Johnson. Dawa is from Tibet, Mercy is from the Philippines, and Jackie is from Trinidad. Over the past 5 years, they've helped me and Will take care of our children. We're lucky. Some people cannot afford this option and have little family support. Every mother needs a wife. Some mothers' wives are their mothers. Some mothers' wives are their husbands. Some mothers' wives are their friends and neighbors. Every working person needs someone to come home to and someone to get them out of the house. Someone who asks questions about their day and maybe fixes them something to eat. Every mother needs a wife who takes care of her and helps her become a better mother. The women who have helped me have stood in my kitchen and shared their lives. They've made me feel better about working so hard because they work hard too. They're wonderful teachers and caretakers, and my children's lives are richer because they are part of our family. The biggest lie and the biggest crime is that we all do this alone and look down on people who don't. Can't we all agree that more eyes on a kid is ultimately better? Doesn't that at least lower the chances of him running into the street? Now, let me tell you about this music class I took my kid to once.
Nobody looks stupid when they're having fun.
Every mother needs a wife. I've always had a job, so when I had my two children, I didn't assume I would stop working. I slowed down, which I was happy to do. I was grateful that I could. Most can't. However, I had no plans of being a full-time stay-at-home mother. This is not to say that I think being a stay-at-home mother is not a job. It certainly is. It's just not for me. Remember my motto, good for you, not for me. The whole business of working mothers and stay-at-home mothers is so touchy. Well, tetchy, if you're a Brit. The subject inherently sucks. Not a week goes by without annoying and bullshit articles claiming breast milk makes kids better liars, or you should only have one child unless you live in a farm. We torture ourselves and we torture each other, and all of it leads to a lot of women-on-women crime. Here are some examples. A stay-at-home mother is introduced to someone as Aiden's mom, rather than her own name, which apparently doesn't matter. A working mother is out at a function and people say, "What are you doing? Don't you have little kids? Who's watching them?" A new mother talks about how she's breastfeeding her baby because she just wants her baby to be healthy. A working mother sees a woman breastfeeding and asks her, "Are you still doing that?" A working mother acts like she's too busy to answer emails. A stay-at-home mother acts like she's too busy to answer emails. A stay-at-home mother talks about how she doesn't work because they're only young once and she doesn't want to miss a thing. A working mother talks about how it's not quantity, it's quality. A stay-at-home mother needs a nanny, can afford one, and refuses to hire one, and in doing so denies her kids another caring and nurturing adult and denies herself some much-needed personal time and self-care. A working mother relies too heavily on her nannies and feels defensive about it, so she overcompensates by talking nonstop about some weird music class she took her kid to once. A stay-at-home mother approaches a working mother and grills her about how many hours she works. She gets really interested in what time the working mother leaves in the morning and comes home at night. Then she comments, "I honestly don't know how you do it." I've gotten that last one a lot. The "I don't know how you do it" statement used to get my blood boiling. When I heard those words, I didn't hear, "I don't know how you do it." I just heard, "I don't know how you could do it." And I would be feeling so overworked and guilty and overwhelmed, and suddenly I would be struck over the head by what felt like someone else's bullshit. It was an emotional drive-by, a random act of women-on-women violence. In my fantasy, I would answer, "What do you mean, how do I do it? You really want to know the ins and outs of my nanny schedule? Do you want to know how I balance childcare with my husband and the different ways I manipulate and negotiate work to help me put my kids first when needed?" Sometimes I would fantasize about answering the question, "How do you do it?" with quick one-word answers. Ambivalence. Drugs. Robots. Of course, the ultimate comeback would be, "Well, obviously you don't know how I do it, because you don't do it. You couldn't. What do you do again?" See what I did there? Crime. There's an unspoken pact that women are supposed to follow. I'm supposed to act like I constantly feel guilty about being away from my kids. I don't. I love my job. And mothers who stay at home are supposed to pretend they're bored and wish they were doing more corporate things. They don't. They love their job. If we all stick to the plan, there will be less blood in the streets. But let me try to answer the question for real. Do you want to know how I do it? I can do it because I have a wife. Every mother needs a wife. My wife's name is Dawa Choden. Sometimes it's Mercy Caballero. It used to be Jackie Johnson. Dawa is from Tibet, Mercy is from the Philippines, and Jackie is from Trinidad. Over the past 5 years, they've helped me and Will take care of our children. We're lucky. Some people cannot afford this option and have little family support. Every mother needs a wife. Some mothers' wives are their mothers. Some mothers' wives are their husbands. Some mothers' wives are their friends and neighbors. Every working person needs someone to come home to and someone to get them out of the house, someone who asks questions about their day and maybe fixes them something to eat. Every mother needs a wife who takes care of her and helps her become a better mother. The women who have helped me have stood in my kitchen and shared their lives. They've made me feel better about working so hard because they work hard too. They're wonderful teachers and caretakers, and my children's lives are richer because they are part of our family. The biggest lie and the biggest crime is that we all do this alone and look down on people who don't. Can't we all agree that more eyes on a kid is ultimately better? Doesn't that at least lower the chances of him running into the street? Now, let me tell you about this music class I took my kid to once. My world-famous sex advice. I think sex is great. I love it, and I'm here to say I'm good at it. Here is my world-famous sex advice. Please follow it to the letter, and don't challenge me on any of it. Note that all of this advice is meant for older people, strictly 80+. This advice works for both straight and gay couples, but you'll have to do your own work with switching the pronouns. All sex, in this instance and in every instance, should be between consenting adults. Thank you in advance. Ladies, listen up. Try not to fake it. I know you're tired/nervous/eager to please/unsure of how to get there, but just remember to allow yourself real pleasure and not worry about how long it takes. If it makes you feel better, set a time frame. Say to your partner, "I think you're going to have to work on me for close to 45 minutes, and then we can see how it's going and regroup." God punished us with the gift of being able to fake it. Show God who the real boss is by getting off and getting yours. That being said, stop being so goal-oriented when it comes to sex. You might not make it to the finish line every time. Don't worry about it. Each part of the journey can be great. Keep your virginity for as long as you can, until it starts to feel weird to you, and then just get it over with. But try not to have your first time be in a car. Don't have sex with people you do not want to have sex with. Remember that no matter how old you are, every time you see that person, the first thing you will think of is, "I had sex with you." Don't get undressed and start pointing out your flaws or apologizing for things you think are wrong with your body. Men don't notice or care. They're about to get laid. They're so psyched. Men are very visual, so if you don't want them to look at your stomach, just put fake mustaches on your breasts to distract them. Get better at dirty talk. Act like a bossy lady ordering at a deli. "I want the ham on rye, and make sure you toast it." If your guy is bad at dirty talk, tell him to shut up. He might like that. And if you don't like dirty talk, don't worry about it. I mean, it's pretty hot if done well, but it may not be up your alley. Also, try to not stick things up your alley. Don't let your kids sleep in your bed. You have to have sex with your husband occasionally, even though you're exhausted. Sorry. Don't make fun of men. Don't be mean to them or hurt their feelings. Try not to crush their dreams or their balls. Stay away from pics and videos. They last forever, and you don't want a snooping babysitter, me, to find them. And finally, laugh a lot and try new things with someone you love. Okay, gentlemen, rules for you. Eyes up here, please. We don't need it to last as long as you think. Hurry up, we are so tired. We don't want to remember your penis. We want to remember everything else, but hopefully your penis is just a wonderful blur of goodness. If your penis is too big or too small or goes to the side or has a weird thing, we will remember it. And if you have something very weird, tell us right away so we aren't wondering if you know. And then we can laugh and get back to doing it. You can't fall asleep right after. You have to stay awake for at least a few minutes. Remember, if you fall asleep, we will stare at you and evaluate you. This is a very vulnerable time when we may decide we don't want to have sex with you again. Keep it sexy. Don't believe what you see in movies. It really isn't cute when you stick out your gut. Cool it on the porn and jerking off. We think porn is great, and so is jerking off, but if we are going to have sex, it may cause some problems. If you depend too heavily on the technical or visual, then you may not notice the real flesh and blood person in your bed. Be nice, tell your woman she is hot, never shame her, and never hurt her. Work on your dirty talk, too. Try different things, but keep trying. Avoid the words climax, moist, and mom. Don't speak in a fake accent or blackcent. If you don't get an erection, we know it's usually not because of us. We look concerned because we're wondering if it will keep happening. Stay away from orgies. They take so much organizing, and I feel like your time could be better spent. Open up and try new things with someone you love. And finally, if you don't eat pussy, keep walking. Give me that pudding. I've been nominated for some awards. This is very cool. I've hosted a few award shows, which is also cool. My first was the High Times Stony Awards in 2000, and the last was the Golden Globes in 2014. The Upright Citizens Brigade had a strong and early relationship with High Times, which was then a magazine filled with Jerry Garcia conspiracy theories and sexy centerfold pictures of weed. For you young listeners, the term magazine used to mean a collection of printed pages that you would hold in your hand and read by turning the pages. Still confused? Try this. Picture folding your MacBook and sticking it in your pocket. Oh, you kids don't use MacBooks anymore? You use eyelid screens and mind cameras? Oh, bully for you. I digress. Let's all just agree that acting awards are strange. They're based on the idea that a committee of a select few puts a bunch of very different performances next to each other and then decide who gets the pudding. Now, don't get me wrong, to be in the company of other great actors and valued for your work is a whole lot better than being ignored. Nothing is worse than being ignored. Glenn Close said it best when she told Michael Douglas in the romantic comedy Fatal Attraction, "I will not be ignored, Dan." She was so upset about being ignored, she cooked a bunny on the stove. You don't even want to find out what I would do. A lot of people don't know that I am always this fucking close to doing some crazy shit. Getting nominated for an award is very exciting, and anyone who says it's not is either lying or on a very strong beta blocker. You have a 1 in 5 chance of getting the pudding. That being said, I have not won very often. Always a bridesmaid, I guess. By that, I mean people are always mistaking me as someone from the movie Bridesmaids. I've also been mistaken as that girl from Mad TV, and Chris Rock once called me Rachel Dratch, proving once and for all that Chris Rock is horribly racist. The worst part of being nominated for any award is that, despite your best efforts, you start to want the pudding. You spend weeks thinking about how it doesn't matter and it's all just an honor, and then seconds before the name of the winner is announced, everything inside you screams, "Give me that pudding!" And then comes the adrenaline dump, followed by shame. You didn't even want the pudding, and here you are upset that you didn't get it. You think about all the interviews you did talking about the pudding, or all the interviews you passed on because you didn't want people to think you wanted that pudding too much. You leave the award show hungry and confused. To combat this, I decided to distract myself in that awkward and vulnerable moment the winner was announced. I decided to focus my attention on something I could control. Bits, bits, bits. The first time I was nominated for an Emmy, it was for Best On-Screen Orgasm in a Dramatic Civil War Reenactment. Just kidding. It was for Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy for SNL. And as would become the norm, I was included in a great group of women whose work I admire. I had an idea we should all wear mustaches when our names were announced as nominees, and then I heard Sarah Silverman, who was nominated for Outstanding Lead Actress, was planning on doing the same thing. She had even brought her own mustache with her. I chalk it up to great minds. A quick scramble ensued, and I collected a series of props in hopes they would work. If I remember correctly, they consisted of some crazy glasses, an eye patch, and a monocle. You know, the things every girl must have in her purse when on the red carpet. I remember how fun it was asking the women if they wanted in on it and how quickly everyone said yes. Jane Krakowski, Kristen Wiig, Kristen Chenoweth, Elizabeth Perkins, and Vanessa Williams were all game. Since Vanessa's name was announced last, I thought it would be funny if we all did something stupid, and then Vanessa just shook her head like, hell no, I'm not doing the stupid bit. I called her from the car on the way to the show and started to feel better. First, because I had a secret, and that's always exciting. But second, because my brain was focusing on something besides the pudding. We all did the bit, but because we didn't let the producers know we were doing it, and it was the first award of the night, they didn't put our faces on the screen inside the auditorium, so it all kind of played to silence. This only goes to show the commitment of all those women to stick with the plan, no matter what. Julia Louis-Dreyfus wanted very badly to join in, even though she was in a different category, which shows you how much power distraction can hold. I ended up having a very fun night and coming to the realization that the less seriously I take these things, the better. I honestly don't even remember who won that year, Kristen Chenoweth. The following year, I was breastfeeding a 6-week-old Abel. I was too tired to think of bits, but my hormones were telling me to just jump on stage and grab the award before they announced the winner. Luckily, I had enough oxytocin floating around in my body that I didn't care or notice who won, Edie Falco. Jimmy Fallon hosted and crushed, and I sat in the front row and heckled like any good friend should, and then dragged my new mama ass to the after party with what Tina referred to as my impressive temporary rack. I broke my toe on the banquette I was dancing on. That's right, on. I acted like the blue-collar party machine I had been raised to be. John Hamm and I held Emmys that weren't ours. We called ourselves losers all night, and years later, threw a loser's party where winners had to donate money to charity to get in. The next day, this mother of two woke up with a swollen foot and hobbled to the airport. Lucky for me, and deeply unlucky for him, I ran into my old friend Bradley Cooper, who was on the same flight that morning. I asked him to escort me to my seat. I imagine the paparazzi photos the next day lauding Cooper for helping an old and confused lady find her way. Then came 2011, the best pudding quest yet. A few weeks before the Emmys, I was having dinner with Martha Plimpton, Andy Richter, and his wife, writer Sarah Thayer. Andy and Sarah were some of the first people I met and hung out with when I came to New York in the mid-90s. They were already married then and had a duplex apartment where they threw great parties that brilliant writers like David Sedaris and David Rakoff attended. They were real adults at a time when I was still a struggling kid, and they were always generous and kind to me. At dinner, we all discussed a fun bit that could keep my mind off the pudding again. And I was reminiscing about the great old bits done by Harvey Korman and Tim Conway. I had loved one particular moment when, as soon as their names were called, each man just immediately got out of his seat as if he had won. They stood on stage together, and when the winner was announced, they both shook Chevy Chase's hand and sat back down. It was simple and funny and supportive and stupid, all great things. We decided that this year, Martha and I, along with our fellow nominees, should do something similar, but add in a beauty pageant element. I emailed my fellow nominees for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy, Laura Linney, Edie Falco, and Melissa McCarthy, and they were all in, of course. I knew my girl Tina was down to clown, because she herself was breastfeeding at the time, and as history has shown, this is when a bitch is most likely to go off. I gave the producers just the right amount of info so they could shoot our bit properly this time. We had someone buy a crown and flowers, and slowly my craving for pudding vanished again. I desperately wanted to go up on stage first, because I thought the person who went up first would get the biggest laugh, but Edie Falco was first alphabetically, and it seemed too grabby to ask her to switch. As luck would have it, Edie Falco emailed me a few days before and asked me if I would like to go on stage first. I pretended like I was doing her a favor, but I was super psyched about it. Rob Lowe and Sofia Vergara read my name, and I just got out of my seat and pretended I had won. Standing up there, I could feel the audience's delight and confusion, followed by pure joy when Melissa and the other women followed suit. Everybody added their own twist. Martha Plimpton screamed like she was Miss Virginia, Laura Linney pretended to wipe lipstick off her teeth, and Tina tried to kiss Jack McBrayer. We all came up on stage and held hands like we were in the final moments of a Miss America pageant, and I felt like I might die from happiness. When Melissa won, we all genuinely screamed with joy. Standing on stage being funny with those ladies was so much better than winning. I can only assume I didn't win. I forget who did. Melissa did. It doesn't matter. In 2012, I felt a little pressure to do something better, which isn't helpful because there's nothing worse than being the sweaty one in the group leading the charge. Plus, I was going to the Emmys for the first time without my husband of 10 years, and I kind of just wanted to hide. Instead, I sat next to Louis C.K. Louis really doesn't care about the pudding, which is one of the many things I love about him. I also love that he's really honest, gives great advice, and knows how to drive a boat. To combat my nerves, I picked a dress that made my boobs hang out, so people would be too distracted to ask me about my personal life. It was very eyes down here, guys. Because of our fun bit the year before, people had started asking me if I had something planned. And this made me sad and self-conscious. Then Julia Louis-Dreyfus called me. It was 2 hours before the Emmys, and I was already 7 hours into my pregame. There is an insane amount of industrial light and magic required to make me look like a pretty lady at an award show, and I will not say that the process is enjoyable. Julia said something to the effect of, "I think one of us will win. If I do, will you do this bit with me? And if you win, can I do it with you?" Suddenly, I was focused on something active and alive instead of worrying about my boob tape. Julia had the idea that we should hug and switch speeches so that the winner read the other woman's speech by mistake. I was so excited about doing the bit that I was hoping I wouldn't win. And I didn't. And I didn't care. Ultimate pudding switch. Hosting the Golden Globes in 2013 with my life partner, Tina, was so fun. You know, sometimes Tina feels like a very talented bungee jumping expert. All it takes is for Tina to softly say, "We can do this, right?" And suddenly, I feel like I can jump off a bridge. Two things also helped me in my preparation for that year. I spent the first day of 2013 touring orphanages in Haiti as the ambassador of arts for Worldwide Orphans. Nothing reminds you of what is important more than being face-to-face with children who lack basic love and care. Plus, my separation had given me a major case of the fuckets. Ambivalence can be a powerful tool. To get ready for our first Golden Globes together, Tina and I spent a lot of time procrastinating and sending texts about how terrible it was going to be. Deep down, I wasn't worried because Tina is the finest joke soldier you could ever go to war with. She also keenly understands the importance of good lighting. We enlisted the help of our great friend and former SNL producer Mike Shoemaker, as well as America's sweetheart, Seth Meyers. We treated the whole thing like we were preparing for Weekend Update, only without a desk and with an audience of 30 million. And on the day of rehearsal, we were told that jokes often leak before the live show. So we stood in our fancy jeans and sneakers and delivered our monologue with the setups only, no punchlines. It was thrilling. When I walked out on stage that night, I realized I was actually a little nervous because I do a weird thing when I'm nervous where I tilt my head back like I'm super confident. This is my attempt to fake it till I make it, or at the very least, make it easier for someone to slit my throat. The jokes went well. The show was fun. Tina and I had the idea to pretend to be fake actors in the audience. I believe we were there representing the smash hit Dog President. We also decided to sit in the audience when our own category was announced and cozy up to some grade A celebrity meat. Of the many things I learned from working at Saturday Night Live, one of them is to not overwhelm people with requests. So on the day of the awards, I simply asked George Clooney's people to check and make sure George was okay with me sitting next to him at some point during the broadcast. "Of course," said George's people after not asking him. I knew enough to not ask them to check with George and see if it was okay to sit on his lap. This was a request better saved for the last minute and in person. Or better yet, when the time came, I would just sit on his lap without even asking. As the old saying goes, don't ask for permission to sit on George Clooney's lap. Beg for forgiveness once you do. So, I sat on George's lap, and ever the pro, George asked me what kind of bit I was cooking up, and I told him, when they cut to me in the audience after announcing my nomination for Best Comedy Actress, I was going to act totally engrossed in talking to him. I told him I thought it would be funny if we were just flirting and laughing. He understood immediately and handed me a glass of champagne. I told him if I won, there was a very good chance I would kiss him hard on the mouth. And he responded, that's not a bad Sunday. As the camera cut to me, he whispered in my ear, the thing about making movies is... there is a reason why Clooney is considered the best. Because he is. The lessons? Women are mighty. George Clooney loves bits, and doing something together is often more fun than doing it alone. And you don't always have to win to get the pudding. It is at this point that Julia Louis-Dreyfus's lawyers would like me to point out that she won the Golden Globe in 2013. It is also at this point that I would like to point out that I won a Golden Globe in 2014. I was sitting on Bono's lap this time, and I was genuinely surprised. And I am now forced to admit that pudding is delicious. Great acceptance speech. Feel free to use. I always assumed I'd be smooth and prepared when I won something, but adrenaline is a crazy bitch. I stumbled through my speech when I won some pudding, and I was too embarrassed to ever watch it. I had written an acceptance speech, but forgot all about it, so I thought I'd read it to you now. I think it sums me up pretty well, and I can't wait to use it one day. Hashtag God willing. What's up? How you guys feeling tonight? I said, how y'all feeling tonight? How you guys feeling over here on this side? Let me hear you on this side. Oh, let me hear you over here on this side. How you guys feeling over here? I'm not gonna forget you guys in the balcony. Woo! I am here because of you. I share this win with you. I believe it was Gandhi who said, winning is everything and the only thing. Big ups to Gandhi and Biggie. Big ups to Biggie. Can't forget Biggie, y'all. Thank you first to God and Buddha. And maybe these days it's a little more Buddha than God. You know what? Screw it. They're both dope. Honestly, most times I wish I was Jewish. They kiss their kids on the head a lot and they seem to know how to argue better. Speaking of Jewish people, I would like to thank my agents, managers, lawyers, publicists, travel advisors, business managers, surgeons, OBGYNs, trainers, and neighbors, and every producer and writer I've ever worked with. Now on to politics. What's the deal, guys? Seriously, I mean, come on. Get it together. It's like, when are we gonna wake up? It's all crazy. Who's with me? Thanks for letting me get that off my chest. Okay, what else? I'm launching a jewelry line, and my pieces are in the lobby and available for sale, euros only. This is also a good time to mention my album is dropping. And by dropping, I mean someone is dropping it, and I need someone else to pick it up and make it. Thank you in advance, Diplo. Let's see, to all my fellow nominees, Lourdes Ciccone, Nancy Pelosi, Eddie Izzard, Animal from the Muppets, and the inimitable Maggie Smith. It's an honor. To my stunt woman, whose name I can't remember, but whose violent death I will never forget, my deepest thanks. To the love of my life, George Clooney, a man who wore me down with letters and phone calls until finally I gave in and let him have sex with me. You're welcome. And finally, I would like to salute our troops by singing a slow and racially inappropriate version of I Loves You, Porgy, from the classic musical Porgy and Bess.
Peace.
If it's not funny, you don't have to laugh.
Bad sleeper. Sleep and I do not have a good relationship. We have never been friends. I'm constantly chasing sleep and then pushing it away. A good night's sleep is my white whale. Like Ahab, I'm also a total drama queen about it. I love to talk about how little sleep I get. I brag about it as if it's a true indication of how hard I work. But I truly suffer at night. Bedtime is fraught with fear and disappointment. When it's just me, alone with my restless body and mind, I feel like the whole world is asleep and gone. It's very lonely. I'm tired of being tired and talking about how tired I am. The phrase going to sleep has always given me great anxiety. I don't like doing things that I'm bad at, and I've been told since I was very young that I'm a bad sleeper. As soon as I become prone, my head will begin to unpack. My mind will turn on and start to hum, which is the opposite of what you need when you begin to switch off. It's as if I were waiting the whole day for this moment. Trying to go to sleep is often when I feel most engaged and alive. My brain starts to trick me into thinking that this is the moment it should turn on and start working overtime. It's a problem. I need some rest. I have a lot to do. Our parents surround us with origin stories that create deep grooves in the vinyl records of our lives. Mine included the simple fact of how little I slept as a baby. My mom and dad nicknamed me Tweety Bird because I was tiny, not quite 6 pounds, had big eyes, and was bald until I was 2. I was told I resembled a cartoon chicken, which is still true, especially after a rough weekend. My parents tell stories about my staring at them from the crib at all hours of the night. Sounds pretty creepy, right? A pale, bald, and tiny baby bird peering out through the slats of its cage, challenging the adults to an all-night staring contest. By all accounts, I came home, and my parents didn't sleep again for another 10 years. I was born in a different time. Women still smoked when they were pregnant, and no one talked about folic acid. Kale wasn't even invented yet. My mother, who was constantly nauseous, was encouraged to keep her weight down by her doctors. She gained only 18 pounds during her pregnancy with me, a fact she was very proud of and told me repeatedly while I was pregnant for the second time and 40 pounds overweight. She may have stopped after I threatened to dropkick her into the neighbor's yard if she mentioned it again. My mother was also a tiny baby, and my grandmother, another petite flower, used to brag that she would put my mother to sleep inside a dresser drawer. It seems like, in the olden times, people loved to stick their babies in strange places and then brag about where they fit. My father also told me a story about using a warmed baked potato as some kind of mitten. I don't know. Things were weird back then. Whatever the case, I was small and a bad sleeper, and these labels have stuck. At a young age, I would grind my teeth and snore. I sleep-laughed and sleep-talked. I didn't sleep-walk, but I sleep-scared my brother, Greg. We would sleep in the same bed on Christmas Eve, too excited to be apart. He was 3 years younger and would easily fall asleep while I did my usual ritual of spending 2 to 3 hours going over lists in my head, worrying about my family, and then reading Nancy Drew books with a flashlight. One Christmas morning, Greg, who was 5 at the time, woke me up to go downstairs, and I looked at him and said, "Okay, let's go wake up Greg." He looked at me with his big kindergarten eyes and nervously said, "I am Greg." From then on, our family has used the phrase, "I am Greg," anytime one of us is having an existential breakdown. One Christmas when we were a bit older, Greg and I got up in the middle of the night and turned all the clocks in the house ahead a few hours. We woke up our parents and opened presents until they finally realized it was pitch black, even though the clocks read 8:30 a.m. Sleepovers were a big thing when I was young. Sleepovers were girl summits. Confabs, where we all snuggled next to each other and decided who we were going to be. They were also stressful social experiments. I had 2 wonderful friends growing up whom I still consider my close friends. I met Kristen Umili in 2nd grade. She was shorter than me, which was a big deal. She was half Italian and talked a mile a minute. She won the superlative cutest in both middle school and high school, but was incredibly well-liked, which gives you a sense of her wonderfulness. Andrea Mahoney, whom I call Sis, was the social quarterback of the whole school. She came from a warm Irish family with lots of older brothers and sisters, and she was a pretty athlete who made everyone feel welcome wherever we were. I was lucky to be included in that sandwich, and as we would line our Snoopy sleeping bags up next to each other, I would sink into the relief I felt from having friends like these girls, smart, patient, good daughters and sisters. That's who I ran with. That being said, I still went through the young girl rites of passage, including being kicked out of the group. Almost every girl goes through this weird living nightmare where you show up at school and realize people have grown to hate you overnight. It's a Twilight Zone moment when you can't figure out what is real. It's a group mindfuck of the highest kind, and it makes or breaks you. I got through it by keeping my head down, and a few weeks passed, and all the girls liked me again. We all pretended it never happened. There should be manuals passed out to teach girls how to handle that inevitable one-week stretch when up is down, and your best friend who just slept over your house suddenly pulls your hair in front of everyone and laughs. The nerves of suddenly being a social